All right, well, we've been talking tonight about polemics, and if you've noticed, lots of people have different approaches when they're talking to Muslims, right? So there are people who wouldn't be comfortable with polemics. So you have apologetics, that's defending Christianity against Muslim objections, defending the doctrines of Christianity. Polemics, that's actually going after Islam, exposing Islam. And then you can have all sorts of other things that might be relevant to a discussion with a Muslim. And so how does all of this work together? Before we talk about exposing Muhammad, just want to draw attention to how all of this kind of connects. Right? If you have an approach with Muslims and you're good at talking to Muslims, stick with your approach. Don't pay any attention to what I'm saying. If you don't have an approach, I can give you one that's pretty helpful and can help you sort out what you need to do in various situations. When I'm talking to a Muslim, I will normally just start with lots of questions. Not being mean with the questions, I'll start off with very, very general things like, what do you believe? What do you believe about Muhammad? What do you believe about the Quran? What do you believe about the Bible? What do you believe about Jesus? What do you believe about God? What do you believe about the future judgment? So on. Because even though there are Islamic doctrines, there can be some diversity of viewpoints within Islam. So I asked this particular Muslim what you believe on all of these issues. Notice, gathering information about what this person believes. So I'd start with a bunch of what questions. What do you believe about this? What do you believe about that? Over time, I would transition to some why questions, right? Not just what do you believe about this, but why do you believe that? So why do you believe this about Muhammad? Why do you believe that about the Quran? Why do you believe these things? And notice now you'd start getting some of this particular person's reasons for what he believes. And then why do you believe that about Jesus? Why do you believe that about the Bible? Now you're getting this person's views on not only just on Christianity, but on why this person believes these particular things about Jesus or about the Bible. But notice, now you've got this person's particular reasons, and now you kind of have an idea of what you need to do, right? If this person has certain objections to Christianity, then in order to deal with those, that would be apologetics, right? And if this person says, well, why I believe this about Muhammad is because, and gives you some reason, well, if this person's reason for believing in Muhammad is false, which it will be, that would be a good area for some polemics to show this person that that claim about Muhammad is actually wrong. And notice also, to do something like this, you don't have to know everything from the start. Right? There are lots of people there concerned, hey, I don't want to go talk to a Muslim when this Muslim's going to have all sorts of objections to Christianity that I might not be familiar with. He's going to have all sorts of arguments about Islam that I may not be familiar with. There is absolutely no shame in saying, hey, you just made a claim about Muhammad and I've never heard that before. Would you mind if I get back to you on that? I'd like to go look it up. Could you point me to a couple sources where I can go read about that? And I'd like to talk to you more about that. I mean, think about it. You'd be happy if someone said that, right? You made a claim about Christianity and the Muslim said, well, I've never heard that before. Would you mind if I get back to you on that? You think, wow, that's really cool. Well, guess what? That's how it would seem if a Muslim brings something up and you don't know about that issue and you say, hey, I want to get back to you. But notice also then the conversation keeps going, right? Because now you're going to meet with your Muslim friend again. And so if the Muslim has claimed, for instance, that the Quran has been perfectly preserved or something like that, well, I've never really studied that. Would you mind if I looked into that and then got back to you? So I would start with lots of questions, what questions, transition into some why questions. And now you find out where this Muslim stands on a variety of issues, and you know what you've got to deal with. But it's just going to be very, very common that a Muslim has been given a lot of complete nonsense throughout his life or throughout her life about the Quran and Muhammad. Jay pointed out, he said, we don't make the kinds of claims about our Bible that they make about the Quran. There is a tendency in Islam to just use this extreme kind of language about anything they're describing in Islam, right? It's not enough to just say, you know, we have pretty accurate pretty accurate representations of what Muhammad delivered. It's got to be perfect preservation right down to the letter in every single manuscript of the Quran in all the world. I have Muslim apologetics books which claim that. It is utter complete nonsense. For some reason, the apologists do not feel content in just saying, there's widespread agreement on most of the Quran. They won't say that. Perfect preservation right down. Not only that, they will not just say perfect preservation right down to the letter from the time it was revealed to Muhammad. They will say, and every expert, Muslim and non-Muslim, agrees with this. It is completely false and ridiculous. No expert agrees on that. But what they're told in their apologetics books and in their dawah books to invite people to Islam is complete nonsense. And I'm going to give you an example here. I brought this up to read an excerpt from a book called Towards Understanding Islam. This is a book that is given out on college campuses across this country. It's called Towards Understanding Islam. You really want to understand Islam? Get this book. And in the section on Muhammad, it goes on for this a long time. I'm just going to read you a quotation here. So this is the description about Muhammad that you would read. He is entirely different from the people among whom he is born and with whom he spends his youth and early manhood. He never tells a lie. The whole nation is unanimous in testifying to his truthfulness. He is the very embodiment of modesty in the midst of a society which is immodest to the core. He helps the orphans and the widows. He is hospitable to travelers. He harms no one. He is such a lover of peace that his heart melts for the people when they take up arms and cut each other's throats. In brief, the towering and radiant personality of this man, in the midst of such a corrupted and dark environment, may be likened to a beacon light brightening a pitch dark night, or to a diamond in a heap of dead stones. After he begins to deliver the message of Islam, the ignorant nation turns against him. Abuses and stones are showered at his august person. Every conceivable torture and cruelty is perpetrated upon him. Can anyone ever imagine a higher example of self-sacrifice, brotherliness, and kind-heartedness towards his fellow beings than that a man would ruin his happiness for the good of others, while those very people for whose betterment he is striving should stone him, abuse him, banish him, and give him no quarter, even in his exile? And that in spite of this all, he should refuse to stop working for their well-being? When he began preaching his message, all of Arabia stood in awe and wonder, and was bewitched by his wonderful eloquence and oratory. It was so impressive and captivating that his worst enemies were afraid of hearing it, lest it should penetrate deep into the recesses of their hearts and carry them off their feet, making them forsake their old religion and culture. It was so matchless that the whole legion of Arab poets, preachers, and speakers of the highest caliber failed to bring forth its equivalent. This reserved and quiet man, who for a full 40 years never gave any indication of political interest or activity, suddenly appeared on the stage of the world as such a great political reformer and statesman that without the aid of radio, telephone, and press, he brought together the scattered inhabitants of a desert extending across 1,200,000 square miles. He joined together a people who were warlike, ignorant, unruly, uncultured, and plunged in self-destructive trivial warfare under one banner, one law, one religion, one culture, one civilization, and one form of government. He accomplished this feat not through any lure, oppression, or cruelty, but by his captivating manner, his winsome personality, and the conviction of his teaching. With his noble and gentle behavior, he befriended even his enemies. He captured the hearts of the people with his boundless sympathy and human kindness. He did not oppress even his deadly enemies, men who had sworn to kill him. He forgave them all when he triumphed over them. He never took revenge on anyone for his personal grievances. He never retaliated against anyone for the wrongs perpetrated on him. It was he who turned the course of human thought away from superstition, the unnatural and the unexplainable, towards a logical approach, illustrating a love for truth and a balanced worldly life. In the cavalcade of world history, the sublime figure of this wonderful person towers so high above all the great men of all times that they appear to be dwarfs when contrasted to him. Can anyone cite another example of a maker of history of such distinction, another revolutionary of such brilliance and splendor? It goes on like this, page after page after page after page after page. I was given that by Muslims who wanted to teach me about Muhammad. I used to read that out loud to torture my wife. If I wanted to annoy her, I'd just start reading that out loud. She goes, "Stop it! I can't take it anymore!" Right? But think about that, right? Just based on what you know, is anything I just said there true? Islamic apologetics is just say every praiseworthy thing you can possibly think of. Who cares if it's false as long as it makes Muhammad sound like the greatest man who ever lived? Guess what? They'll do the exact same thing with the Quran. They'll do the exact same thing with particular arguments. So you'll find stuff like that that talks about the amazing scientific brilliance of the Quran. It'll just go on like that. Total nonsense, but it'll just be chapter after chapter filled with this sort of thing. We'll talk about women in Islam, the role of women in Islam. It'll be just like that. Muhammad was the greatest feminist who ever lived, and they'll just shower praises on him like that. There's this tendency to just shower praises on something over and just no concern whatsoever with reality. And that's how you end up with claims like perfect preservation of the Quran right down to the letter. Now, here's the question. If that is what Muslims hear about Muhammad when they start studying Islam. Because keep in mind, when your average Muslim starts studying Islam, he's not going to J. Smith. He's not going to me. He's going to his books by his apologists. And that's what he reads. So that's what he learns about Muhammad. That's what he learns about the Quran. And then he hears people like us. Obviously, we must be in rebellion against God if we're going against such clear evidence, right? I mean, obviously. So here's the point. If you take someone who's been saturated with this kind of information, with these kinds of claims, all his life, and you go up to him and say, "Hey, did you know Jesus died on the cross for your sins?" Chances are that's not going to be persuasive. Now, there are people who go up and preach the gospel to a Muslim, and the Muslim accepts the gospel. Chances are something else was going on beforehand, right? Chances are God was working on this person in other ways. Generally, a person who has had that poured into him all his life is not going to take you at all seriously if you come up and present some alternative. So this is why yesterday I mentioned that Nabil told me after he became a Muslim, that when we were having our discussions, he realized that Christians had good reasons for what we believe, that we have good reasons to believe that Jesus died on the cross, that Jesus rose from the dead, that the New Testament is reliable. But in his mind, he was always thinking, you know what, even though they have a good case for this, even if they showed me with 99% certainty that they're right, I'm still 100% sure that Islam is true. And so Christians always lose, even if they have good evidence. Why? Because Nabil was raised on things like that. Right? Nabil's raised on those kinds of claims about Muhammad and the Quran. So this is where polemics would come in. Right? This is where you would walk in and say, actually, talking about Muhammad never harming anyone and being the greatest moral example who's ever walked the planet, there are some other things in your sources that weren't mentioned in your little book here. And I'm just wondering why they weren't mentioned, right? So just so you know, we're talking about exposing Muhammad. We're actually talking about kind of strategies. So this isn't going to be a list of problems with Muhammad's character or something like that. I've got plenty of videos on my YouTube channel if you want to check those out. But just to give you some ideas of the kinds of things we're talking about, and we're going to talk about some strategies for how you might use these. Muhammad, let's go down a list here. Muhammad had sex with a 9-year-old girl, all right? Kind of a problem. He married her when she's about 6. She had some sort of health problems, that her hair fell out and so on. Eventually consummated the marriage when she was 9. And according to Muslim sources, she had not reached puberty yet. So Muhammad had sex with a prepubescent 9-year-old girl. Muhammad married the wife of his own adopted son after causing the divorce by lusting after her. Right? His adopted son, named Zayd, had a wife. He was one of the most beautiful women in Arabia. Muhammad saw her practically naked, started praising Allah, and his adopted son divorced her so that Muhammad could have her. People complained, and in order to justify that marriage, Allah abolished adoption in Islam. So in order to justify his relationship with his adopted son's wife after causing the divorce, Muhammad abolished adoption, because people still complain. You can't marry the wife of your own adopted son. That's gross, right? So Allah abolished adoption, said there's no more adoption anymore in Islam, so he's not his adopted son anymore because there's no adoption. One of the most humane practices in history, adoption. Now, to be fair, you can still take care of an orphan in Islam. You can take care of an orphan, but you do not adopt an orphan so that that orphan becomes part of your family. You don't do that in Islam anymore. It was abolished in order to justify Muhammad's relationship with Zainab. Muhammad once got caught in his wife Hafsa's bed with his slave girl. It's no shocker that Muhammad would have sex with his slave girls, but got caught in his wife Hafsa's bed. Hafsa goes out to the market. She comes back, catches Muhammad in bed. Muhammad took an oath. His wives got really mad at him for doing this. Muhammad swore. He took an oath. I will never have sex with my slave girls again. Opening verses of chapter 66, Allah comes back and says, Muhammad, you just swore an oath to your wives. I didn't tell you to make that oath. It's gone. And Muhammad continued having sex with the slave girls, eventually got Mary the Copt pregnant. Muhammad's wife, Hafsa, once she got old and unattractive to him, was going to divorce her because she was getting, she wasn't as attractive as some of his younger wives. So she actually pleaded with him, said, look, I will renounce some of my marital rights. You don't have to come see me. You don't have to visit me. Just don't divorce me. And the time that you would spend with me, you can spend with Aisha, your child bride. And the Quran actually praises her for making that arrangement. Instead of saying, what are you talking about? I'm not going to divorce you. I have a commitment here. Nope. It was good job. Good job, Sauda. So you find those kinds of things. You have the violence issues, the terrorism, the calls for the violent subjugation of Jews and Christians and for the forced conversion of pagans. You have the killing of apostates. You have these kinds of things. You have the things that he taught his followers so they could beat their wives into submission. They could rape their female captives that they capture in battle. Even if the women are married that they capture, they can still use them as their sex slaves. Prostitution, Muhammad allowed prostitution. You could give a woman something like some food, a loaf of bread or something like that, in exchange for 2 or 3 hours of marriage. That was the catch, right? It's prostitution. You're paying the woman, but you're paying her to marry you for 3 hours. Right? So then you have sex with her, she's gone, and it's all perfectly halal because you married her. Right? So these are the kinds of things that you find in the Muslim sources. Your average Muslim knows nothing about anything I just said. Never heard it before. What has he heard? Well, he's heard stuff, the kind of stuff we just heard in towards understanding Islam. So this is the kind of information you want to share with a Muslim if you're able, in order to start to counterbalance the praises of Muhammad that he's heard all his life. But that can be kind of difficult, right? You're bringing up some sensitive information. If you believe Muhammad is the greatest man who's ever lived, if you believe he is as you've been reading about him all your life, then when someone starts saying, actually, he did some really, really bad stuff, you don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that. And you would think, again, someone like Jay Smith or me was telling you something bad about Muhammad. Wait a minute. Everyone I've trusted in my life has told me the exact opposite of what you're trying to tell me right now. So it can be very tricky, but can be extremely helpful. I started bringing up a lot of these issues with Nabil when we started talking about Muhammad. Just so you know, just because someone acts like none of this is bothering him does not mean that it's not bothering him. Maybe he didn't tell me until after he became a Christian. But a lot of the things we were talking about, he really didn't have a problem with. He didn't have a problem with Muhammad and Aisha. He did have a problem with what the Muslim sources said about what you can do to female captives. You go out and fight a town, what can you do with those captives? He did have a problem with that. And he was just thinking, what if that were my wife and sister? I mean, what if that were my mother and sister? Would I think that that's okay? So, but when we were talking, he gave me no indication that this bothered him at all. He didn't tell me until later after he became a Christian that was tearing him up inside, that he viewed Muhammad as the perfect man and Muhammad was doing these kinds of things. So these kinds of issues can be very important to get across to a Muslim. Question is, how do you do it? And there are few things that might help in your polemics. So let's just talk about the most obvious thing that we would be thinking of. If we're talking about strategies on how to get this information across, the most obvious one would be the direct approach, right? The direct approach. Hey, your prophet had sex with a 9-year-old girl. What's up with that? Right? That's the direct approach. I wouldn't always use the direct approach. I think there are situations where you can use the direct approach. One, if you have a close friend and you're just on that level where, hey, we're friends, he knows I have his best interest in mind and that I just want him to go to heaven, and I know that he has my best interest in mind. So when he criticizes Christianity, I'm not gonna get upset. I know he's just trying to show me the truth here. So we know that we have each other's best interest in mind. Therefore, he knows when I start blasting him, it's not personal. I reject his prophet, and I'm on a level with him where I can just talk that way. So if you have a good friend, like Nabil and I were friends like that, I would just come guns blazing on some of these issues, and Nabil was fine with it. And he'd come guns blazing at the Bible. And that was fine. We're on that level. So that's one situation. Another situation where you might want to do that, someone's being a real jerk. You might just want to let him have it on Muhammad. No, and there are situations like George is telling me one day he was out in front of the mosque. And he's out in front of the mosque, and he's preaching to one person, and there will almost always be someone who wants to come out and just like distract everyone. So he said he's sitting there, he's talking to someone, and someone comes out and starts yelling, "Well, why are so many priests pedophiles? What's up with all your pedophile priests?" And George said, "One second." And he went, he had Sahih al-Bukhari in his car, right? And so he goes back and he brings it. He's like, "Hey, you're complaining about pedophiles? What's this right here about Muhammad having sex with a 9-year-old girl?" And George still has a scar in his mouth from a guy punching him in the mouth over that. Nevertheless, that seemed like a good place to bring that up, right? Even if there are times when you just gotta get punched in the face and hope that some information gets across there, right? So that's a situation where you might want to, someone's just being a jerk and they're doing, you might want to bring it out in that situation. If we're talking on YouTube, my YouTube channel, I'm usually just pretty direct in the things that I'm saying. But there's a reason for that. If someone's going on YouTube and they see my video titled Muhammad and Aisha, you know what you're getting into there. Right? So if you don't like it, hey, you clicked on it. Stop it. So that's the direct approach. That would be one, and that would be a few situations where I think that the direct approach, just coming right at Muhammad with some information, right at the Quran, something like that, would be possibly the best approach at that time. But not always the best approach, depending on the situation. So there is also what I would call, so this would be second, the non-confrontational approach. And some of you are thinking, no, I love confrontation. I don't want the non-confrontational approach. Well, guess what? There are lots of situations, and probably most of the time, where a non-confrontational approach would actually be better and be more helpful. Because one of the main tasks in polemics, if you're dealing with Islam, is all of this information that Muslim leaders have kept Muslims insulated from for all their lives, you want to get as much of this information into them as you can. And if you walk up to them and say, "Hey, what's up? Your prophet had sex with a 9-year-old girl." Well, that information might get into that Muslim, especially if you handed him a source and showed it to him or something like that. You might get that information into his head, but he might not want to talk to you ever again, so you might not get anything else into his head. You know what I mean? So, a different route. And this is, you know, generally if you're talking to Muslims, if you have a Muslim friend, you know, another Muslim student or a Muslim coworker, here's the thing. You can get the exact same information across, but in a non-confrontational way. So notice the difference here. Notice two approaches here. hey, your prophet had sex with a 9-year-old girl. That's gross. Look, here, it's right here in your sources. Don't try to deny it. That may be the correct approach in certain circumstances, but think about how that would differ from, hey, I was reading this article by this total jerk named Sam Shimon on Aisha, and he was going through some of your sources and was actually claiming that one of Muhammad's wives was a 9-year-old girl. I don't just want a Christian's perspective. I would love to have a Muslim's perspective on this. So I've printed it out. If you wouldn't mind, because you know you're one of the only Muslims I know, would you mind looking over this, looking through this, and maybe giving me a response and telling me what you think of this, whether you think he's correct in what he's saying here, or you know, if you believe that Muhammad is the greatest man, you know, what do Muslims believe about this relationship here? You could, you know, maybe talk to your imam about it and just basically give me some more insights into how you would see this. And lots of Muslims would be fine with that, right? There you're not blasting, you're not attacking, you're asking for more information. I would love to hear what that Muslim, and you know, I would love to hear what a Muslim has to say about this. But notice there, you might actually have a Muslim who goes and reads an entire 18-page article by Sam Shimon, and then, not just that, has to think about it and wrestle with it and try to formulate a response to it, try to formulate a defense of what Muhammad did, and then come back to you and actually try to offer a defense. That can be way, way, way more powerful than just tossing out an accusation and that's the end of the discussion, right? So it can be way more powerful if a person is actually wrestling with it and trying to formulate a response. And when a Muslim comes back and says, well, here's what I, you know, here's what I was looking into this, and here's what I think, you know, it's just a, you know, it was a different culture back then, and they start explaining that, and okay, well, thank you for that, I appreciate that. I probably wouldn't even say anything about it until like a week or two later. Then I would have some further questions about, no, remember when you said, right? And then would have some follow-up questions, right? But notice, if you take that approach with your Muslim friend or your Muslim coworker, you might over time get a lot more information into that person's head. Now, to be fair, you don't get to complain if that person starts blasting Christianity, right? You got to be fair here, you got to be consistent. And so when that person says, hey, you know, I have a real problem with this in the Bible, all right, well, I'm going to get back to you on that, and we will discuss that. So that would be the non-confrontational approach, and I would say a lot of times that is a better approach for polemics. Notice you're still doing polemics, you're still getting that information across, but doing it in a less confrontational way. So those are two sort of overall broad approaches. Now, a couple more things. We don't have terribly much time, but we have a couple more things. One, so this would be number three if we're talking about strategies. I would call this the Nathan tactic. Remember the prophet Nathan? Remember the prophet Nathan? So David, King David, saw a woman bathing, decided to have her, committed adultery, got her pregnant, in order to cover up the mess, had one of his soldiers who'd been fighting for him all his life, had him killed in order to cover up the mess. Nathan the prophet wants to tell David he did something wrong, but keep this in mind. This is a guy who just committed adultery and murdered someone to cover it up. You're going to run up guns blasting against this dude? Hey, man, let me tell you how messed up you are. Might have been okay. But Nathan used a somewhat different tactic. Nathan said, hey, you know, David, got this issue. There's this poor guy in the town, and there's this rich guy in the town. The poor guy had one little lamb, and the rich guy had tons of stuff, and a person came in from out of town to visit the rich guy. Instead of using one of his tons of sheep he had, he took the poor guy's lamb. What's up with that? David said, that guy deserves to die. And then Nathan, of course, says, you're the guy, right? So notice, he got him to condemn his own behavior before he ever knew that he was talking about himself. Because when you're in selfish mode, self-preservation mode, people can, you know, you're going to justify anything you do. Whereas if you think you're talking about someone else, might not be ready to justify. You might be ready, you might be thinking more clearly and think, no, that is horrible, awful behavior. When in fact, what David did was far worse than what the guy did in taking someone's, you know, lamb. So David acknowledged that he was wrong. He had already condemned his behavior. He understood, wait a minute, I would condemn this in anyone else. Why would I justify it in myself? Well, that can be helpful. That can be helpful in certain situations. If you're doing some polemics and you're trying to get a Muslim to realize that his prophet has some problems. Because the tendency is going to be to justify anything, Muhammad did, to automatically interpret it in some positive light, even though there is no justification whatsoever in the source. So, how do you go about this? Well, you know, you could try it in certain ways, like with Aisha. When I was talking to Nabil, my wife is a half Filipino, and one day I said, hey, Nabil, you know, my wife's cousin's in the Philippines, and he's marrying a 9-year-old girl. What do you think about that? It didn't work. Nabil didn't fall for that. He's too smart, right? He said, well, you know, if it's a different culture, who are we to judge, right? So he didn't fall for that. But you can't, you know, that's that sort of thing, where you give someone an example of someone else doing it, and what would you think about that, right? What would you think about someone hiring a prostitute and then marrying her for 3 hours or something like that? You can bring up the situation without bringing up Muhammad. And the person who has no idea that Muhammad did that might be willing to say, yes, there is something wrong with that, before you tell him, oh, well, actually, Muhammad did that. Muhammad did that. Now, why did you think it was wrong 2 minutes ago? Now you're going to try and justify it and say it's actually okay. So that's one way you can go about that, just bringing up hypothetical scenarios of people. What would you think of a man who did such and such and such and such? Another way to do that is when people are condemning someone who actually did something. Like I was doing this when, people were complaining during the Trump campaign when Trump, they posted a comment of Trump when he was saying, hey, you know who's beautiful? He's on the Howard Stern show. And he said, you know who's beautiful, really beautiful? Paris Hilton. Because Paris Hilton was friends with Trump's daughter. But you know, the people pointed out, but she's only 15 years old and he said she's beautiful. So look, I mean, he's lusting after a 15-year-old girl. So I would just take that. Hey, all of you are saying this is horrible. What about Muhammad here? Why? So obviously this would be worse, right? And of course, no one would have a problem with Muhammad having sex with a 9-year-old girl. So situations like that where people are in the process of condemning someone, right? And these always come up, right? You just had the guy who died in his cell and things like that. And there are always these situations where people look at this thing this awful person has done. And you can say, okay, well, you condemn that behavior in him. What about what Muhammad did right here? Is that a problem? And this isn't just relevant for Muslims. This is relevant for everyone because I think people in general need to learn this information about Muhammad. It has to become common knowledge. Because keep in mind, when the Muslim preacher comes out, when he starts preaching that stuff, if people do not know any better, if people know nothing about Muhammad, people convert based on that stuff. People convert based on those kinds of things. So those are a couple of things, but I'm actually almost out of time. So we'll just do... yeah. I'll just zoom through them real quick. One is, number four here would be, we'll call it the chess master mindset. The difference between a good chess player and a bad chess player, one of the main differences is the chess master is thinking multiple moves ahead, whereas the bad chess player isn't. He's just thinking, here's what's on the table. One of the good things to do, one of the good habits to get into, is if you know you're going to be bringing up some information, if you can anticipate, well, here are the three things that Muslims can say in response to this, and here are some other issues that will come up when this person is talking about this, right? And you can actually plan for that discussion. So if you're thinking moves ahead, if you're thinking multiple moves ahead, you can actually start with a topic even though there's a bigger topic that you want to get to. So for instance, I'll bring up, hey, Muhammad ordered his followers to kill dogs and they went on a massive dog killing campaign. You like dogs, don't you? Everyone likes dogs. What's up with that? And then the Muslim justification would be, oh, but you know, that was only for a time. And later on, his followers complained that they said they liked dogs and they liked hunting dogs. So they switched it. They changed, you know, Muhammad changed his revelation. Now it's just kill dogs, except hunting dogs. And then it became, you know, just kill black dogs because, you know, they're the ones that are really possessed and things like that. So The revelation, Muhammad's decisions about dogs and killings, it just changed from time to time. So the real discussion that I want to have is, doesn't it seem like this is all, he's just getting his revelations as these issues come up, and none of it is really clearly from God, and he's just sort of inventing this as he goes along? That's a discussion I want to have. So you can have situations where you're bringing up an issue, but you're thinking multiple moves ahead in order to get where you're going and bringing up further issues. And so that's four. My time is up, but I don't really care. What's George going to do to me, right? He's going to come up and drag me off stage. I weigh like twice what he weighs. So I'll just give one last one. Call this the tipping point paradigm, right? If you've been raised on that sort of information about Muhammad, that he is so great in so many ways, then bringing up a specific issue like Muhammad and Aisha, you may be able to endure your confidence in Muhammad while knowing that he had sex with a 9-year-old girl, because that's, you know, I've got all of this mountain of proof that he's the greatest man who ever lived, and then I have this. And that's why they will try to interpret that in some positive way. You ask Muslims about that, they will say, it's because he saw her immense potential for memorizing hadiths, and so he understood that the best way she was going to be able to pass on this information that we know about him now from the hadiths is if he married her, and she was around him constantly. So he saw this amazing potential. This was for her, right? And so it'll be stuff like that, right? They have to interpret it in some positive light. You can do that if it's one issue. You can do that if it's two issues, three issues. Eventually, if you see more and more information over and over and over again, you eventually reach a kind of tipping point, right? Where it's, I can no longer justify this. And we've seen lots of people leave Islam who said that, I defended it, and then you brought up this, and then I defended it, and I brought up that, and I defended it, and eventually I couldn't defend this anymore. I could not defend this guy anymore. And that's what you're kind of trying to reach with an individual. Again, there are different kinds of Muslims who need different kind of approaches. Assuming it's a Muslim who believes in Islam because of all of these, kinds of reasons, and you're responding to those reasons to try and get him out of that mindset. If it's that kind of Muslim, then it can take a lot of examples before you reach that tipping point. But here's the thing. Even though you want to reach that point with individual Muslims, I would like to see the world reach that tipping point, right? Because what does the world hear about Islam? They don't hear a lot of the polemics, because there aren't a lot of us doing it, right? What do we hear? We hear one unified message from politicians, from the media, from educators, from entertainers. Muhammad was wonderful, and that's all there is to it. And then we come along and say, actually, we've got some problems here, and we sound like we're crazy, right? So what happens is Islam remains a live option for people. All of that keeps Islam as a live option of this. If you want to believe in something, Islam is one of the things that is worthy of your belief. I'm convinced that if the facts about Muhammad ever became common knowledge to where everyone is aware of these things, I don't think Islam would be a live option for most people. I think they would regard it as utterly absurd. And so if we can ever reach that tipping point as a nation and as a world where it's just so many facts about Muhammad that are now common knowledge and that are disturbing, then, one, I don't think we're going to see many people, if any, converting to Islam, and I think we're going to see a landslide of people who are leaving Islam. And if you're a Christian preacher, that's right where you want to be when you see people leaving Islam. You want to be there waiting for them with the gospel.